Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 322 of the podcast. It's Thursday, 18th of May, 2017, as I record this a little early, as I'm heading to Crime Fest in Bristol. And it's always best to talk to you guys before I hit the bar and the panels with the renegade crime writers of Britain. We do have a fun time as well as providing great value to the reader audience. So today I have an interview with Lisa Van Pelt, who is a bookbinder, and we talk all about her cool process and the beautiful materials she uses and why print and digital will continue to serve different audiences or the same audience for different purposes. So Lisa rejuvenated my desire to create limited edition print products on paper that I hand make with my own words and Well, that might be a way off quite yet, but it is a super fun interview and a little different to all the emphasis on digital marketing and all that. So coming up in publishing this week, in fact, just as I started to prepare the introduction today, Amazon steals the news with the announcement of Amazon Charts, which their press release calls a bestseller list for what people are really reading and buying, which I think is hilarious, as opposed to the increasingly opinion-based chart lists like the New York Times. And they don't explicitly say that, but I mean, they essentially are saying that, you know, these bestseller lists that don't take into account Amazon sales or, you know, reads are just, well, they're not bestseller lists, basically. So it's really interesting. And I predict that this will now become the challenge. People will go, right, I want to hit the Amazon charts. And if you do have a look, I think it's just amazon.com/charts. I lost the link in front of me. But basically, there are two authors. They list the publisher as well. And there are two authors on that list who do not have a publisher listed, who are KU. So I think those are indie authors, which is very cool. So indies are already on that list. It is only Amazon.com right now. I do hope they do these in the other country stores. Certainly in the UK, the bestseller lists here are pretty much all merchandised and monopolised by traditional publishing and print books. So yeah, really interesting how that's going to develop. The Guardian UK also reported this week on indie authors getting Hollywood deals. Of course, the most famous are E.L. James with 50 Shades of Grey, which actually only got a film deal once it had been bought by traditional publishing, but started out as indie, and The Martian for Andy Weir. Other authors have options like A.G. Riddle, Jerry Riddle, and Hugh Howie. And this article in The Guardian also includes friend of the show and co-host of the self-publishing Formula podcast, Mark Dawson, who has interest in his John Milton series, hopefully to be announced soon. So very cool. The Guardian is quite renowned for making negative comments about indie, and there's been all this press in the last few weeks about the demise of ebooks and always the rise of print. So really good to see quite a positive spin on Hollywood interest for indies. And of course, I've had Mark on the show several times before, and I wanted to give you a heads up about an exclusive conversation, which has not gone on the blog. It's on the website, sort of on a hidden page. I'll be sending it out to my email list, but I wanted you guys to hear about it. It's an exclusive conversation about self-publishing tips. We discuss the fundamentals you need to have in place, recommendations about ebooks and print when you're starting out, exclusivity versus going wide, how to get your book sales moving if you have no platform, no email list, no author friends, no nothing, and also what to do when you have a few books out but you want to rejuvenate sales. So you can go check that out at thecreativepen.com/self-publishing tips. And hopefully you'll find that useful. There's a video, audio, and a transcript. So hopefully that will help. Okay, my personal update. I am currently babysitting for my cousin and have been looking after three kids this week. So I, you know, hats off to all you parents who manage to do this job with children.
I've had significantly less time this week, but all the time I have had, I've been spending on How to Market a Book, the third edition. I have the audio narrator booked for the end of May, and the pre-order is up on Amazon, Kobo, iBooks, and all the usual places. So I need to get it finished and copy edited in the next, 10 days. So I'm putting in a lot of hours on that. It's amazing how much has changed in author marketing, and also how much I've changed since 2014 when the last edition came out. And it's really good for me to revisit some of the assumptions I have. And yeah, I think this will be a really useful book for everybody. I've also put out two big blog posts this week, one on money, art and ambition, lessons learned and pictures from Damien Hirst's Wreck of the Unbelievable exhibition. Sorry, treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable. So I talked about that last week, but now I've put up a more considered post about my lessons learned. And it's definitely got me thinking about the things that I want to create for a sort of long-term legacy. Really interesting stuff. And I've also blogged my breakdown of the last financial year's worth of book sales, which I did mention last week. But it's all there in black and white. So I've actually gone through, you know, my percentage split between different formats, different vendors, fiction, nonfiction, and some of the things I might be doing differently in the next year. So all there on the blog at thecreativepen.com, and I'll put links in the show notes. Okay, also useful this week, go and listen to the Selma Book Show, episode 163. I listen to the Selma Book Show every week, and often Brian and I steal news from each other. Just depends when the news comes out and how we, you know, who gets to report it first. But really interesting show this week, featuring another Brian Meeks, guest hosting along with Brian Cohen. And they talk a lot about Amazon ads. And I actually got some really good ideas from it. So I think this is the real key with book marketing. Sometimes you might hear things a number of times and then you hear it like the fifth time or something, and it clicks for you. Some really interesting stuff if you're just starting out on Amazon ads, or if you're already using Amazon ads and you want to change things up a bit. Brian Meeks has a book coming out on Amazon ads, and he will be coming on this show when the book is out. But for now, this is a really super useful conversation. So check that out, sellmorebookshow.com, or just on your usual podcatcher, episode 163. Right, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Here's just a few of them. Benjamin Douglas says, I love the description of the Damien Hirst exhibit on this week's episode, and a nice insight into Michael Anderley's model as well. I'm glad you like that. And I talk a lot more about the creator workshop model on that blog post. Karen Inglis, who is a fantastic children's book author, and I refer any children's book indie to Karen's site, Inglis, if you want to Google Karen, because she blogs all about her self-publishing journey. And Karen's been on the show a few years back now, but Karen tweeted a superb interview on bundling, box sets and collaboration and platforms to help you with the back end. So really enjoyed that show with Chuck. Sido, or S.E. Bouvier, says, great interview, Dean Crawford, very inspiring. I now know I must aim for 20 published books. And I know 20 can seem a bit daunting, but it's amazing how fast they rack up over the years if you keep putting them out. Eileen Omoza says, listen to the ebook bundling for author show while admiring my Mother's Day 2017 inspirational card, which looked lovely. And finally, Aubrey Spivey says, honestly, nothing motivates me more than waking up to a new Creative Pen podcast, #Monday motivation. Thanks so much, Aubrey. I'm really thrilled that you guys enjoy the show. And please tweet me at The Creative Pen, or you can always email joanna@thecreativepen.com with what you are doing when you listen to the show, or where you are in the world, because I'm always interested in where people are, and photos from where you are. Love that. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from them in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So as ever, a massive thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patrons, Lindsay Carlson, Melissa E. Beckwith, Amina Cavallo, and Dave Holtgren. Lovely, friendly profile pic there, Dave. I really liked seeing your grin this week. So thanks to those new patrons, and thank you so much to everyone who's been supporting the show on Patreon for what is now about 18 months, which is fantastic. I really appreciate your support on Patreon. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can throw in a coffee or two a month, and you'll get that extra monthly Q&A audio, which I recorded and put out last week. So that is available now. And of course, you get all the backlist extra audio. So if you can't get enough of my voice, then go check that out at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you. Let's get on with the interview.
Hello, creatives. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Author Relations at Kobo. Because you're a creative Pen listener, chances are you already know Kobo is a global company. But did you know that Kobo has merchandisers around the globe creating unique web store views in major global territories? Did you know that we have special features on local authors in those territories? Similarly, the top 50 bestseller lists and the category rankings on Kobo are unique. So we have about 17 different bestseller lists. And due to recent improvements on Kobo.com, you can actually see how your book is ranking in a territory other than the one you live in. So if you're looking at your book on Kobo, what you want to do is go to the very top and click on the country flag, which will probably be showing the country that you were viewing our website from. And that will bring you to a page that basically allows you to check from 18 plus different countries. So if you're an American, you can see what your book looks like in Canada. If you're in the UK, you can see what your book looks like from Australia, etc., etc., etc. This is handy because it can help show you what your currency looks like so you can take advantage of our ability to set prices in 18 different currencies. But you can also see, if you happen to be selling really, really well in those territories, just how well you're ranking there. That's just one of the improvements we've been making at Kobo. We're going to be making more. You can find more tips like this at KoboWritingLife.com. Looking forward to seeing you there. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Today, I'm here with Lisa Van Pelt. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Lisa is a bookbinder, which is very exciting, specializing in designing and producing limited edition fine press books, cases, boxes, and paste papers. And you can see examples of her work at lvpbookbinding.com, because of course, this is such a visual media. Now, Lisa, like, I'm grinning like a crazy person because it's so romantic. It just seems so romantic to be a bookbinder. So tell us, how did you become a bookbinder and what do you love about it?
Well, sometimes I used to tell people that I just got into bookbinding so that I could have these big, huge cast iron pieces of equipment in my studio. But basically, I got into it because I studied bookbinding. No, I didn't actually study bookbinding in college, but I studied architecture in college. And then after college, I apprenticed with a bookbinder in Western Massachusetts, which oddly enough is a hotbed, no pun intended, of letterpress printers and bookbinders and book-related artists and artisans. And bookbinding, oddly enough, uses some of the same skill sets as architecture. So designing and building books is similar to designing and building buildings, but just on a very small scale. So that's how I got into it. And that's what I love about it, this sort of design element and the actual getting to build what you design, the collaborative process between the bookbinder, myself, and whatever artist or small press, whoever's commissioning the work. We collaborate in designing the binding, the structure, the materials, all that sort of thing. So that's really what I love about it. It's really just a fantastic way to spend time.
Yeah, it sounds so awesome. But I think we should probably just get back to basics. There might be people listening who don't really understand what bookbinding is. So, you know, many people listening will be authors who have CreateSpace or even Ingram Spark print on demand. Some people might have done a limited edition print run, but there will probably be very few people who have had a project working with someone like you. So maybe you could just explain, like, what's the difference or what is it actually?
So the work, so of course, bookbinding is, there's a whole spectrum of what people do in bookbinding, and it can go anything from, you know, blurb online or doing like ink print through Ingram Spark, and then, which is all, machine based. And then, you know, there's the trade paperback in the middle, and then there's, you know, the hardcover trades. And then there's the handbound sort of spectrum of things. And, you know, I have friends who will get a book, as a bookbinder, will be able to get a book digitally printed and then hand bind the cover. I work with people who are, I work with letterpress printers or printers who are printing in some other fashion, and they do the printing, and then I get the sheets from them and do all of the work of creating, turning those sheets into a book. And whether that's just the binding or it's the boxes that's housed in and all of that sort of thing. So along that spectrum, I'm sort of on the far end where, you know, rare book publishers are commissioning the work of, say, 1 to 50 copies of something. So it's a small edition, fine press books that are usually end up in institutions or rare book libraries. So kind of it's a rarefied sort of art form. Sort of, I make books the way we used to do 500 years ago, basically.
Yeah, which is cool. We're going to come back to the death of print in a minute. But I do just want to come back. You mentioned having massive equipment in your studio. I mean, I did one day of bookbinding, and I made this little notebook thing, and it was awesome. And it was full of like crazy equipment. So I'm just really interested, like, how expensive are those big devices? Like, because they, not too many people must want them, to be fair.
Not too many people want them. They really don't make them like they used to. I mean, you can actually buy the modern day version of some of the things. Like the two pieces I have are really just massive. I try not to move very often because they take a lot of, you know, the standing press that I have is 7 feet tall and it weighs almost 1,000 pounds. And just because it's cast iron, you know, obviously they don't make them like they used to for some good reasons, but also they function really well. And I think I got the cutter that I have, which has it's this massive board shears and it has a 4-foot blade, basically, so I can cut very large pieces of material. And I got that from an Amish guy in Pennsylvania who used to collect those things and refurbish them and remachine parts and sort of keep them up and running. But it's 100 years old or more than that. So the newfangled versions you can purchase. But so those old tools, they make them still, but the functionality is still the same. So it's very non-mechanized, you know, mostly just beautiful function of old machines. So not that there aren't new or mechanized things that I use. Like I used a hot stamping machine for titling book covers. And so it's obviously electric. And so I use that to heat up type in order to basically do a foil stamping of a title on covers and labels and things like that. And then I actually use a dry mount press. So that's pretty newfangled machinery. And I use that to back cloth in order to use it, back it with back cloth with paper in order to use it in books. And then, of course, there's a bunch of hand tools, which you got introduced to in the, the bone folder and the, all kinds of knives and paring tools for paring leather and all sorts of things like that.
That's very cool. It's awesome. But it sounds like tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment.
Oh, that's right. That was your question. How much does it cost? So the board shears that I use, I don't know, maybe it was a few thousand dollars. Mm. That was 15 years ago. So
yeah, I guess they last a long time.
They do. I'll never have to buy a new one. So and who knows if I'd ever be able to get rid of it, but I may go to the grave with that.
But well, so, I think that's interesting. I mean, I guess the reason I asked is because I went to this particular, workshop where people could go and rent the equipment and things. So right. We're not suggesting like people yeah. would set themselves up with all the equipment, but there are often in certain bigger cities, right. people can go to these workshops, can't they? Maker spaces and use exactly. them collectively.
Exactly. And there's centers for the book in lots of the large cities like San Francisco, near where I am, New York, all sorts of, outside the United States, there are different types of either maker spaces that just happen to have bookbinding tools or what usually get called like San Francisco Center for the Book. Mm-hmm. And they have, both letterpress printing tools and also bookbinding tools. You can rent time in the studio and take classes to learn how to mm-hmm. use the equipment, all that sort of thing.
It's super fun. And I think that's the best way for people to get started. And as I said, I think as a business person, as an author, we have to focus on digital because that's where the profit oh, yeah. margin is. But yeah. I want to ask you the question that boringly everybody asks everywhere I speak. It always comes up. In fact, I was at this conference last weekend. So, it was on the future of the book and someone put their hand right. up and said, seriously, are ebooks the death of print? And I just want to bang my head against the wall. But, what are your thoughts, in terms of the so-called death of print, or what is happening with print? Are we seeing like vinyl, resurgence type of thing? Or what do you right. think that it's all happening?
Right. Well, I look at it as ebooks solve a different problem than print. So they are by far the best mode of getting information and text distributed far and wide for the most or the least amount of production cost. Just like the trade paperback what answered that question back in its day. Mm-hmm. And now ebooks are doing that. And so I guess you could make an argument for the development of ebooks pushing print into, it could push print into a new direction. Like there could be more of a resurgence of interest in the sort of specialty print objects or beautiful print, as I've heard you mention before. And so that could sort of push that into more of a specialized type of presentation of a text or artwork. But just like digital photography didn't make painting obsolete, I feel like they're two different, they're responding to two different problems mm-hmm. or questions or needs or whatever. So, and obviously ebooks are not the death of reading, because more and more people have more access to reading material through ebooks. So I don't see that the rarefied world that I am in terms of printing and bookbinding, I don't see that declining because of ebooks. I don't know how many, perhaps the trade hardback industry is sort of less robust than it used to be, but mm. I'm not sure that that's a terrible thing, but
yeah.
I don't know. I shouldn't make any proclamations, but that's what I would say.
Mm, but you haven't seen but you're not worried about your business falling apart because ebooks are going to eat your lunch, right?
No. It definitely, we're responding to different world of books. So I do that thing where I obviously buy and read ebooks. I sometimes buy the hard copy of the ebook that I own because I like to look at things or, dog ear pages or things like that. I like the physical nature of the book still. So I think for different uses, different types of material, print maybe for me is still the most useful form, but the immediacy of the ebook often gets me to buy both. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, you're an ideal reader. And I have I have some books in print, ebook and audio. So I
right.
mean, yeah,
exactly.
It's kind yeah. of crazy, but only nonfiction actually, which brings me to the question, what are the best types of projects for the limited edition work that you do? So, or what are some examples of projects that people would invest that money? Like, I can't see me ever doing like a service like yours for, you know, one of my novels, which are fast paced thrillers that you right. read and finish, right. but maybe with a nonfiction book. So what are some of the projects you do and what are the books that suit this kind of work?
So the type of stuff that I do is so small presses or rare book publishers will commission me to do these like limited edition books. And they tend to be original artwork paired with prose or poetry. So these are the kind of what in trade language would be the coffee table book, but they're the sort of, these end up in the libraries and rare book collections. And so the higher price allows us to focus on the beauty of the materials and the functionality of, you know, an interesting binding, or, you know, making sure it opens in a particular way. And so that you move through the images and the poetry or whatever it is in a particular, not only sequence, but a rate, and you have a certain, it's really controlling the experience, it's sort of building that experience of moving through the work of art. And so that's the sort of book that it would make sense to do, you know, a high end fine binding with, because that's the sort of book that a book collector is going to bring into their library, or, you know, the Getty Museum is going to put in their collection or something like that. However, then I was mentioning before that I have know somebody who they digitally print a book for someone and then put a binding on that. Like they work with it in the same way, in the sense that they're working with the client and they're designing something that reflects the character of the book. But it's because it's digitally printed, it really brings down the cost. And so there's that sort of interim different steps along the spectrum that you can use hand binding.
Oh, that's really interesting. So I know this is could be as long as a piece of string, but the people who then sell those books, because you're like, you're the craftsperson, and then they are the ones selling those finished products, right? Are they like, you know, they would sell them sort of $50 to $250, like that type of price range?
More in the few thousand.
Oh, really? Wow.
5,000 range, sort of. That's sort of where... That's where a lot, you know, it can be as low as maybe 1,000 and then upwards of that.
Wow.
So,
how much bling on that?
Right. Well, and a lot of the bling is the artwork inside. Like, for instance, it's a well-known artist, and so they're collectible, and that's why we're spending all this time and money on the binding and that sort of thing, but not necessarily all well-known artists, and not all well-known known artists, but it's not just the binding that's creating the bling, but it's definitely the art and the poetry or whatever's inside. So yeah, it's definitely a book that I can't afford. And it obviously, that's exactly why it's not answering this accessibility question. What I would really like is that in the future of virtual reality, we'll be able to go into libraries and be able to turn through these, you know, rare books and actually experience them. Because right now they're pretty inaccessible to the general public, unless you make an appointment with a rare book librarian and go see the work. And you can do that, absolutely. But it's not the same as...
Yeah, and it's interesting because the British Library, they've digitized a lot of like the Codex Sinaiticus, you know, and a lot of the really old manuscripts. So you can open it online. So you can see it on a browser and you can zoom in. But like what you're saying with virtual reality and that kind of haptic, the touch, that's what I would want. Because, yeah, sure, I can zoom in and look at it on screen, but that doesn't, I don't know what vellum that's 4,000 years old feels like
exactly.
I don't know how they will do like. That
maybe yeah. we can have that too.
What smells like, yeah. I mean, that's and I mean, talking of virtual reality, I would love like to come and watch you in VR do your stuff. I mean, there's definitely ways that craftspeople can you know expand in that world, and I think this kind of physical craft is a really good example of how that will help. But let's just come back, because I'm still like, wow, seriously, there are books that are that expensive. So tell us about the materials. I mean, yeah, everyone's like, oh, okay, so maybe gold leaf on there somehow. Sure. But what are the types of materials you would typically work with, or that you get excited about working with?
So they run the gamut, of course. And so, you know, there's obviously book cloth and leather and vellum and handmade papers. I do custom paste papers, which is just painted paper, you know, in designs for specific projects. One project, I use this very thin metal. It was thin enough, not foil thin, but thin enough that you could fold it over a board. But basically, I patinaed it using a blowtorch. And so I was like painting with a blowtorch on this metal. And, you know, and so you've got all, and, you know, you can use, I mean, you can basically, you go to any art store or hardware store you go to, you can figure out, look at those materials and figure out how to use them in a book, you know, wooden covers. So all basically, If you can corral a material to a sort of small form, you can use it in a book. And doing that sort of crazy kind of, you try to use this material in a book. That's part of where the cost comes in, but also where the design fun comes in as well. Trying to figure out how can we use, you know, I don't know. So one of my clients will give me these crazy cloth that are not book cloth. They're not meant to be used in book cloth, partly because, you know, they don't function quite as well as a book cloth would. But after a while of making books, you've seen all the book cloths. And so if you want to have a unique and original presentation to your book, you'll go out and find a material that is, you know, off the beaten path and try to make it work for a book. Like, people like artist Louise Bourgeois, she made a book entirely out of her bed sheets, you know, so unique, very unique to her. And so, you know, people will do crazy stuff like that.
That is really cool. I mean, when I did that bookbinding thing, I was like, one day I will print my own paper, put my own, you know, words on it and, you know, work with someone like you to make some beautiful product. Because it's just so cool. But I did want to ask you the weird question. In my book Deviants, I have a character who basically does bookbinding with human skin, which has a name for everyone listening, anthropomorphic bibliopegy, which is skin from human bodies. And my character uses tattoos and makes them. But I mean, it's just leather, right? Human skin is leather. So, I mean, have you worked with anything really weird like that? Or know of these strange projects?
Well, I have not, I admit, worked with anything as exotic as human skin. But it's true that after you've processed it, it would function, I imagine, very similarly to calf skin or sheep skin or goat skin. Goats, though, you know, we particularly use calf and goat skin in the work that I do. But yeah, I mean, so that's definitely an example of taking a material and you know, figuring out how to use it for a book to obtain a particular effect. As I imagine it does.
Creepy so, effect. Yeah, right? I mean, that's what's so cool. I mean, vellum is calf skin, right?
Yeah, well, and goat skin. So it can be either. And they even have things, I wrote it down because I don't use it, but it's kind of more in the grotesque end. It's called uterine calf parchment. So it's a little, I don't use it, and I haven't actually heard of it until I started doing some research on vellums. But there's all sorts of, you know, more, there's all sorts of interesting, weird, and maybe things you might not want to use, but it's out there and available for you. So maybe not that. On a big scale, but on a small scale.
I do. I mean, I think it's really fascinating. Like you said, you have to start thinking, well, you know, if you find a material you like, how could you use that? Or something that has a meaning. So Cory Doctorow did some handbound of his own books, and he put, he used some of his own something in the cover so that it really was limited edition, a bit like the Louise you mentioned. So exactly. Making that limited edition personal thing, I think, is really interesting. That's very cool. And then you mentioned there, obviously, the collaboration process of design, and how, you know, how much do you get to input into the design, and how much are you, you know, letting the client come up with something, or do they trust you with things? What's the collaboration process?
It ranges. So I tend to have repeat clients. So a client will do one or two books a year, and I'll do them with them. And some of those clients come with a material, like, I want to use apple green leather on this book. I don't know how, but here it is, and see what you can come up with. And then I read the text and I figure out what the book is sort of trying to say, you know, what I think it's saying to me, and then come up with a binding that sort of works with that. So in the green calfskin realm, it was about the title was Skin of Grace. And so it was sort of about the skin that, you know, overlays the skeleton, not as macabre as that sounds, but in that realm. And so, I used, you know, designed a spine where you could see the sewing through the spine. And so it was like you were seeing the skeleton of the book through the skin, literally the goat skin. And then sometimes somebody will come and with a book and a real idea for what type of book structure they want. And I'll do things like suggest different, you know, materials, suggest maybe a structure, you know, I'll give them the pros and cons of what they want. Like, that structure can be great for this, but it also won't lie flat. If you want it to lie flat, we could adjust it in this sort of way. So I sort of walk them through what they want and make sure they know the pros and cons of each, because everything has a upside and a downside. And then there's the other spectrum where they're like,
do this,
the other spectrum where people's like, I don't know. I want something really, you know, fun or different or whatever. And then I'll just come with ideas, you know, I'll spend time in the middle of the night imagining new and interesting ways to put a book together and then tell them about it.
I love that. I hope other people, I'm like, oh, wow, this sounds like a dream job. Maybe I should do this. And it's so funny because I think maybe anyone who wants to write or is a writer has this attraction to the print book that will never go away. And it's kind of a completely separate thing to the business of being a writer, which is quite strange. And we'll come back to the business of being a craftsperson in a minute. But just talk a bit about fonts, because fonts are one of those things that everyone struggles with in book design, I think. Are there different fonts for the binding, or, you know, are you using the same types of fonts everyone else is, or, you know, how does that work?
So the printer who's printing the book, and sometimes it's the designer or the book publisher will be involved with the printer in helping them, you know, picking the particular font that works well with the text. I am basically replicating the font that is in the book so as to marry, you know, the cover with the text. But of course, all the text, and similar problem to book design and ebooks, the font, you know, it contributes or detracts from readability. There's fonts that have a lot of space in them, some that have very little. And, you know, so usually the printers and publishers doing these books that I bind, they look for a font that, you know, is trying to express the character. They have a little more leeway, right? So it's usually not as text heavy as an, you know, a work of fiction or something like that. And so the readability is maybe that slide bar on the readability is less of the important. And, you know, for instance, I just bound a book that the cover title is calligraphy, but I can't read it at all. So, you know, I didn't do the calligraphy, you know, and it's gorgeous as a work of art in and of itself, but it's not exactly like you're going to read the letters in there. So, you know, so we have a little more leeway in that, but, you know, but there are fonts that, you know, if it's a book about flight, you might choose Centaur because it has a lot of air in it, or, you know, you can really take it to all these, you know, minute levels of reference and style. So, but that's definitely, I'm glad that that is the printer's job, because it's definitely a difficult task to choose fonts.
Yeah, it's one of those crazy things. But yeah, like you say, it really gives an idea. So that would offer, like you mentioned about designing the paper as well, like some of the, you know, what was it? End papers.
The paste paper.
Yeah, paste papers. I don't really know what that is. What is a paste paper?
It's basically a decorative paper. It's another 500-year-old art sort of thing where you take starch and paint and put them together. And by starch, I mean like flour. And you make a flour paste and you put paint in there, and you're able to paint that onto a piece of paper and make designs in it. The starch basically makes it so that you can work with the paint and move it around before it dries. And so you can come up with, you know, just simple lines or whole, you know, intricate patterns, and you can do individual artworks just with paste painting as well. But when I make a paste paper, I'm making something that I can replicate 100 times, which limits the amount of individuality from sheet to sheet, although every sheet is different because it's handmade. And so when I make those for a project, I will basically try to communicate. It's just like making usually what I'm doing is I'm making paste papers for the cover. And so just like in designing an ebook cover where you're trying to communicate something about the book through what the cover looks like, that's what I'm trying to do with the paste paper as well.
And I'm imagining like a bit like stirring some big pot and then putting it in a big trough, and, you know, is that what it's like? Or
so you mix up your paint in a sort of bucket or jar or whatever it is, big enough for a large paintbrush, sort of like a maybe as big as a house paintbrush would be. So, and then the method I use is I dip the whole piece of paper in a water bath and I lay it out on a piece of glass. I sponge off the water and then I paint on the paint and that's mixed with paste. And then I've got that really flat surface and the paper stuck to the glass. And then I can work with the paint on top of it. And then I take it up, put it on a clothesline, forget about it, and move on to the next one.
That's so cool.
Very simple, very simple process and really fun. Like that's one of the things, like if you get to like learn bookbinding, sometimes like one of the funnest workshop stuff is like painting your paper or making paper or doing something like that. So then there's the book structures and all that sort of thing too. But
yeah, wow, that sounds really fun. I think I might be better at that. I'm just not very good at angles. And I remember when I did the little one book that I did and you have to fold everything, and I was just like, yeah, right. I don't know, like whatever. And
right, yes.
And you have to do all that properly, whereas the paper bit sounds a bit more like, woo, you could just do
a little more loosey-goosey. Yes. Yeah. It's really creative. It's really fun.
Oh, that sounds really cool. You do so many cool things. So I did want to ask you about the, you know, the business of being a creative versus the creative side of being a creative. So how do you market your services and your work?
Mm-hmm. So the work that I do tends to be word of mouth. If I were going to do more, you know, so I have my website online, but it's sort of like a business card online, the way it tends to function in my work. I do, you know, I can go to in person to book events in the Bay Area, and that's, you know, and meet more of the publishers and the printers and the artists and things like that. And that it's basically key. Just being involved in the community is another way to get word of mouth work. So it's all sort of word of mouth. But of course, I only do 5 or 6 projects a year. So there's not a lot of, you don't need a lot of clients to make the business run. So, and other bookbinders might do shorter or smaller projects so that they end up doing more per year. And, or you have studio assistants that can help you do more projects and all of that type of thing. I work alone in my studio and do a small number of projects. And so that means the word of mouth that is going right now is what, works for my business. Mm. I could, and then to ramp it up, you know, to hire more studio assistants and get more work, then it would require more in this sense, more contacting of the printers that I know, what we call in the business, shaking the trees. So, you know, you're contacting the people, you know, who are doing projects and sort of getting on their radar and things like that. Mm. But then I do things like I try to connect with other people in my field by having an Instagram account. So my Instagram account, I just basically post photos of different steps I'm doing in the process, or a finished book, or, you know, or it's raining today or whatever it is. And I follow a bunch of printers and binders, and it's really fun to see their work, helps inspire me. Mm. Especially helps being a lone craftsperson off in an orchard somewhere, stay connected to sort of the wider world of bookbinding. And so the internet has, I think, been a boon for that kind of connection. You can be this craftsperson on your own or with a couple of people in a studio and still be able to connect with people in your industry, people, you know, be inspired by the work they're doing, share successes. And that's a really fun part of how social media helps the craftsperson, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Tell people what your Instagram is.
Oh, my Instagram is an odd name. It's Looky Lisa, like LOOKIELISA. So it's nothing to do with my business name or anything like that. But
people can check that out to see some of the things we've been talking about. So, right, there's just one more question I have for you, which is, you know, really thinking about the handmade and the maker movement. I mean, you know, I follow quite a few makers, you know, who do the maker fair and, you know, this kind of rise of the, you know, do it yourself thing, even down to things like small batch beer, which has become really big, and Etsy, and, you know, even someone like Etsy feels mainstream now. It's really funny. You know, people
really does.
Yeah. Doing that. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yeah. So what do you see for the handmade and maker movement? And this kind of, like you mentioned, artisan at the beginning, you know, what do you think is going to happen with that movement as we move in more and more into the technology side on the one hand?
Right. I think more of what I was just saying is, you know, being able to be that craftsperson, that lone craftsperson or artist, being able to do that while staying connected with the rest of your community. For my personal experience, it's helped, it's challenged me to make better things, more interesting designs, having access to, you know, not only historical works, but what's happening currently is just a way to stimulate my imagination and make me create better work. I definitely see, you know, the people, you know, people can learn things without leaving their home, of course, you know, so if you want to become a knitter, you can learn how to knit. You can join a Facebook group and of people maybe in your area or not, share all these types of things and then use that in street protests. And, you know, so you could definitely, I think it's sort of interesting how the maker movement is using technology in the internet world to both help them learn new skills, but also connect to others and then bring it out into the world, like with yarn bombing. And I don't know why knitting is my only example, but I don't even knit. But anyway, they're doing some really cool things with it. So I think I would just expect more growth in that area and people connecting more and able to learn more, people providing more information online to share skills, you know, so you can build your house watching YouTube and things like that. But, you know, with the indie publishing industry, indie music, all of these things, people, it just seems like things are much more accessible. You want to learn something, it's very easy to do it in term, not, you know, you have to commit time and everything, but it's easy to access the information and easy to connect with people who then want to also take it out into the real world. And, you know, people are learning things that they're creating with their hands. I think it's humans just have an innate desire to create. And so whether it's in a virtual way or not, I do think, you know, building something with your hands, making something with your hands, even if it's cooking, you know, doing that is such a human activity and human desire that I think the access to more information that you get through the digital world will just be a boon to that sort of part of human experience.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I see even more people getting into it as, you know, if we say the, you know, rise of robot outsourcing, for example, and, you know, what I think will be universal basic income, I think people are going to have more time. It might be forced upon them, but, right. You know, and also people living longer. I think, you know, a lot of people getting into this stuff are people who've finished their job and now they have time to do this. So I think there's a lot of potential. And I certainly think with indie authors, I think there's going to be a huge growth. And, you know, I think with the maker movement as well. So I've very exciting times and it's so lovely to hear about your process. And I know people will be very interested in seeing some pictures. So tell us, where can people find you and everything you do online?
Sure. Well, to make it easy, you can type in lisavanpelt.com and that will take you to my bookbinding website where there's a galleries of the work that I've done. And you can also sign up to get an email notification when I actually publish my book, who's the protagonist is a bookbinder. So
exciting.
Learn more about bookbinding that way too.
Oh, I got to ask, is the 4-foot blade involved in your novel?
In the story? Yes.
Excellent.
Not in a sort of bloody way, maybe. But yeah.
I was at my ears pricked up at that. I was like, ooh, that sounds like a murder weapon.
You got to work that money next door. Exactly.
Yeah, great. So, give us that URL again.
So lisavanpelt.com. And also there are links to my social media, Instagram, Pinterest, which I use a lot in, you know, designing stuff. So, and Twitter.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Lisa. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Lisa and definitely check out her Instagram or her website to see some of her book projects, which is super cool. Now, next week, I'm talking about what happens inside the writer's room, screenwriting and pitching your book tips from screenwriter and playwright Adam Gaines, who had actually worked inside writer's rooms in LA on, TV shows and stuff. It's very, very cool and a fascinating topic, particularly applicable after the news about Indies and Hollywood this week. So I'll look forward to that and I'll also report back on the exciting news from Crime Fest. All right, happy writing week and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.